It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast.
To another episode of It's Simple, It's Dumb, It's the Podcast. While it's been a long while since a new episode has found its way to life, I'm determined to get these last five episodes out there, leading up to the new Granddaddy LP Blue Wave that arrives in the middle of February. This episode's guest is someone who actually knew Jason prior to Granddaddy, which is rare for this podcast, as the only other episode like this was when I interviewed Jason's father, Jerome. Our guest today was a skateboarder teammate of Jason's who also happened to become one of the most iconic graphic designers within the industry. Today, we're talking with Ron Cameron. Conversation with Ron, he gives us a deep look into the world of skateboarding in the 80s and explains why creativity was a universal characteristic of the culture. He'll explain how he stumbled across Granddaddy years later, and he will of course touch upon the confusing Music Meant to Accompany the Art of Ron Cameron CD that Jason recorded years later. He'll also share his favorite Granddaddy song, and he has some anecdotes about the song that I'd never heard before. Lots to cover, so let's get started. Here's my conversation with Ron Cameron.
Tell me a bit how you first met Jason and what your first impressions were of him.
I first met Jason through skateboarding, and he rode for Blockhead Skateboards, which is a company that I got sponsored by that was out of Roseville, which is a suburb of Sacramento, by a guy named Dave Withhold. And he just did it. He was trying to make one of the first by skaters for skaters companies, and he was kind of an artist designer himself and stuff. And I got sponsored and when I was 16 years old, and I was already working at a food marketing agency downtown Sacramento. That's going to sound weird that a 16 year old, but that's how I was with commercial art and stuff. So Dave found out that I did art. So I was like, oh, cool. You want to see my art? And he started integrating some of my art into the Blockhead graphics. And by 86 and 87, I was doing full board graphics all by myself. I was doing ads all by myself because at first it was like a collaboration because it was his company. So I was kind of like slowly hijacking his company in a direction that I thought the company should be going. So it's kind of funny, but I was just a teenager writing for a skateboard company and happened to be really into design and music and all that stuff. And Dave responded to that and kind of passed the torch to me. Jason saw some of that, and some of it looked kind of like artists and skaters that we both looked up to before we even met. And that's why he was attracted to Blockhead, because some of my stuff looked like a guy that wrote for GNS called Neil Blender. And he idolized Neil Blender, and so did I. So that was the connection. And he got sponsored by Blockhead, I think, in like 87, 88, something like that. And the first time I met him, okay, this is a funny story. First time I met him, we were in the Blockhead van, and we were going to like a contest, like maybe a Castle contest, which is CASL, California Amateur Sponsored League, or something like that. And instead of us picking him up at his house in Modesto, he has us pick him up south of Modesto by a railroad bridge and a levee on the side country road. And I remember thinking, this is kind of weird. And we went there. And I'm like, God, this is in the middle of nowhere. There's no skater that's going to be out here. And there he is, like, sitting by the road in the middle of nowhere with his backpack, duffel bag, and a skateboard and all his equipment and stuff. And then this is Jason Lytle. He's on our team. He rides vert and stuff. I'm like, oh, cool. And he got in the van and he was with us for a weekend or whatever. So that's how I met Jason. But I didn't connect with him or know him too much back then. And then I think we dropped him back off and then he got another ride or something, but it was just kind of no big deal, but it was picking him up was hilarious. It was like, what the fuck? But, so that's my first impression of Jason is like, okay, this guy that rides vert rad in his own style, but we're picking him up in the middle of nowhere. He's just standing there. So then we went back and, you know, maybe 6 months later or something like that, him and his friends somehow got a vert ramp, which is like a vertical skateboard ramp, built inside the Blue Diamond Almond Factory facility, the processing plant, within the chain link fence and all that stuff. And he invites us over and we're like, what the hell? We're pulling up to like this big, you know, agriculture facility. And we're like, there can't be a skateboard ramp in here. And then all of a sudden we see it through the fence. There's a skateboard ramp and a bunch of people standing on top. And they get somebody to open the gate for us and come in. And we're like, okay. So that was my second experience with Jason Lytle, is that him and his friends somehow got this really good vert ramp built inside a canning factory kind of thing. So I was like, what? And that's when I got to know him a little bit better and stuff. And I skated with him and stuff. But then we moved Blockhead to Southern California, a company Tracker and Trans World licensed Blockhead. So it was like we were getting signed by a major label or something like that. So me and Dave left Sacramento, went to Southern California. And so all these new things are happening. I'm meeting all these new people. I'm losing track of my friends from Sacramento. I'm trying to drive up there. So I'm kind of losing track of Northern California a little bit. And that's right when skateboarding was changing a little bit in 89, 90, and then he got a major injury. I think his ACL got torn or something like that. And he just kind of faded away. And he was just another one of the guys on the team. And then we got a team manager. So we weren't even in control of the team anymore. So I got kind of disconnected. So Jason became another one of those people like, hey, where the hell that dude go? I don't know. And then that was it.
You're from Sacramento. Jason's from Modesto. For those of us who were outsiders to the 80s skate scene in California, how small was that world in terms of familiarity and connections with other skaters? Was it just kind of a lucky circumstance that y'all ended up on the same team? Would you never have met him otherwise, most likely?
Probably not. Probably not. It was just by location, pretty much. But yeah, the whole early 80s and 80s skate scene was like nothing else, and it can't ever be repeated again, because there was parallels going on. There was like, okay, punk rock hit and it didn't get to the US until like 79, you know, and by that time England, it was already dead and turned into post rock and whatever. But you know, it takes a while back then for us to hear about stuff, and punk was a bad word, so the radio wouldn't play punk and stuff like that. But then give it a couple of years and it turned into new wave and stuff. But then the skaters and stuff that were influenced by what they heard of the punk rock and some of the bands that were actually doing it in 79 and stuff made their own bands. And that started coming out around 81, and that was called hardcore punk or California hardcore. And skateboarding, right at the same time, skateboarding was getting bigger, bigger, and all these developments were happening. And then the plug got pulled. And it just died right around 1980. So there was all this energy and stuff. And it was kind of like a match made in anti-heaven, punk rock and skateboarding, because they were both left with like no infrastructure and you had to do everything yourself. You had to try to put on your own contests and stuff. They merged and married. So between like 81 and 83, if you were skateboarding, one of the few that still were, you almost had to listen to punk rock. Like, it was just welded together. You could listen to other music, but you couldn't really tell your friend you did. You're like, oh yeah, I listen to Black Flag and MDC, you know, I'm cool. But, and Dress the Part and everything, which is kind of funny, but yeah, it was all thrift store clothes, do it yourself, artwork, nothing you could buy at a mall. And that was kind of the point. So you go to school and you had short haircut with your ears showing and everybody still had feathered hair. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing? You know? And so in the late 80s, as skateboarding got big again and stuff, that was still a part of skateboarding. Even though we weren't listening to punk rock anymore, there was this whole, we had to do everything ourselves ethos. And that's something that can't ever be repeated again. So we actually had to, like, if you wanted to skateboard in 1984, you had to fight to do it. Cops hated you. Parents hated you. Teachers hated you. Rednecks hated you. Everybody didn't want, you know, you were a skater fag, punker, kook, you know, whatever. You had to fight just to ride a skateboard. And not necessarily really fight, but you got shit. All you got things thrown at you. You got handcuffed by cops, you know, all that stuff. So I think that's in us. So in a lot of like Jason's music, there's a little core of that in there, and you can tell, you know, what we went through in the 80s and why things are raw edges and stuff like that. But that's also where, a lot of characters came out of that skateboard culture too. You, even though you were doing similar weird things, you had to do it your own style. Like you had to have your own take on it. And if you copied that guy, you would get called out on it instantly. Like, hey, your shorts look kind of like James's. What the hell is you doing? You know, and you know, you can't have your hair like that because Rat's Ass has his hair like that, you know, and stuff like that. So it was kind of a funny thing. You had to have your own thing going, which made you be hyper creative. And within skateboarding, all this creativity exploded and there was all these like personalities. So through the few magazines we had, which was Thrasher and Transworld, some characters started developing. Some of the top pros and stuff were like our own little rock stars that nobody knew about. Unless you got Thrasher or Transworld, you had no idea what we're talking about. And we kind of liked it that way. And then if a contest came to your town, then it was just this magical party where all these people were there and we would just rage and have a good time and do all this wacky, weird, crazy shit. And nobody knew about it. It was totally under the radar. So that's where a lot of granddaddy stuff comes from. And that's how, when he started recording it, I was like, oh, yep, still Jason, you know, like you can't take the skater out of him. Okay, I get it. And that was like the zine culture and everything that came out of the 80s. It's all influenced and stuff like that.
You know, earlier you mentioned Neil Blinder being one of your heroes, but it's also one of Jason's heroes. He's mentioned it before a couple of times. In fact, Granddaddy even wrote a song called In Blinder.
This one's called In Blinder.
Does it bother you that Jason didn't write a song named R. Cameron? Does that ever get to you? Oh,
well, I'm nowhere near Neil Blinder. And I
was just kidding.
I would have felt creepy. Well, he did that later, but that was for like an art show. But yeah, that would have made me kind of scared and insecure and like weird. Like, what is he doing? You know, because I always try to stay under the radar a little bit too. I'm a little, I don't know if it's insecure, but I like putting my work out there and letting people look at that and just, you know, like go to an art show and hang around the front and see what people are saying and they don't even know I'm there. That kind of attitude. Well, that was another thing in the 80s. If you were caught tooting your own horn or self-promoting yourself, you were called out on that. You were not allowed to do that. So it was a different era. But yeah, with the Neil Blinder thing, that's a thing entirely unto itself. And I don't even know, like, even if you Google Neil Blinder, you're not going to get it. And there's somebody that a documentary is never going to be made on. He's not going to allow it because he's very reclusive and stuff. I mean, nice guy and stuff, but he just doesn't want any coverage and, you know, isn't interested in that. But to get Neil Blinder and what attracted all of us to Neil, you would really, the only way I mean, you'd have to be in that era and see him at a contest doing outlandish, weird things and stuff. Or if you could track down certain thrashers and certain Trans World Skateboard magazines that had interviews with Neil Blunder, like go for old 80s skateboard magazines that say Neil Blunder interview, you'll get a touch of it, of what the whole Neil thing is. He was the most unique person and super smart, but very rebellious, but not in a tough guy way, in like this, I don't know, this upper level way that was in just weird creative stuff that was genius. And he would bag on people, but it didn't sound like he was bagging on it. And he would just like bullseye them, so you couldn't really argue with them and stuff. And most of it was hilarious. Actually, there is a book, Gary Scott Davis, which is GSD. He was the first pro model street skateboard in like 1984. He worked for Trans World and Tracker and stuff. He just released a book on one of those on-demand publishing companies. I can't remember which one, but it's Stacy Peralta and Neil Blunder, their written notes and stuff back and forth all the way back to the 80s. So if you track down the Stacy Peralta and Neil Blunder conversations book, I can't remember what it's called, but it's just got a black and white cover with like a scribble doodle on it. And Stacy Peralta is the one that made the Dogtown and Z-Boys documentary and then directed the movie and stuff. So there's all these connections and stuff, but that would just be like a tip of the iceberg to getting the whole Neil Blunder thing. You kind of had to participate and experience it because it's unexplainable. He also had a band in 89 called Worked World, but that's just a band. So I think it was like a 7-inch that they released or something like that. But
I was just reading this old interview with Neil, and it was uncanny to me how his responses could have easily been responses by Jason. Like, both have this ability to like see through bullshit, and they're willing to walk away due to the bullshit, you know, comfortable with their decisions that they make on their own terms for their own personal reasons. Even some of the things you were describing, it just seemed like you were describing Neil, but I felt like you were almost describing Jason in a way. Do you see a lot of similarities between the two of them as well?
Yeah, it's an attitude. It's an adopted attitude. It's a way of looking at the world, is what it really is. It's a new way of looking at the world and human beings, and just analyzing that in a no bullshit, pure way with tons of intellectual humor. But that is not highbrow. It's completely average Joe humor. So, you know, so it's really complicated. But, and here's one example. I remember there's like a video, I don't even think it came out in a video, but I would see, not too many people have video cameras back in the 80s. So when somebody recorded something, a lot of times it would end up somewhere at a party and they would play it and you go like, no way. And you get to see stuff or whatever. But I remember somebody was filming like a parking lot, like maybe at a skate park or after a demo or something like that. And Neil was doing something, his antics and stuff. And then he turns around and sees the person videotaping him and just freezes and just stops everything. That was Neil. He was like, oh, somebody's trying to get in on my action and film me? I'm not giving you that. He was like totally in control. It was funny. But that was Neil. It was like, for the purity of it, and as soon as it got blown out and hyped up, he was having no part of it and he would walk away. So even like, I became friends with him when I moved down there through my friend O. And Neil kind of liked me because we'd been in some demos before and stuff, and we knew who each other was and stuff, but we would go record shopping and stuff. I remember that the first time I went record shopping with him at Lou's Records, he was quizzing me on Neil Young. And in 1989, I still wouldn't listen to Neil Young because when I was a kid, I heard that Neil Young shot his girlfriend down by the river. And I thought, I am not going to listen to some guy that killed his fucking girlfriend, you know, in my little kid mind. So I blocked Neil Young. And plus, like, you know, in the mid-80s, he wasn't very new wave or, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers or Stomp or, you know, anything weird like that. So I was, but times were changing and I was trying to get into like hippie stuff and stuff. So I was like, I can't listen to Neil Young. But we went to this Lou's Records and Neil was like, what do you think of Neil Young? I'm like, yeah, he's kind of cool, I guess, you know, but I was like, oh no, because he was totally into Neil Young. And I was like, oh no, I'm failing the test, but I'll just go along with it.
Yeah. So Jason has a funny story that he shared at least once before in an interview where I guess he, as a teenager, he had written this fan letter to Neil Blender. And maybe it was when Neil was, writing for Trans World. But Neil and Steve Carr both showed up at his house unexpectedly. And Jason apparently took them to like some high school house parties and some skate ramps around the Modesto area. That had to be like the most insane thing to actually get an in-person response to a fan letter that you sent to one of your idols, right?
Yeah. Jason told me about that later. I didn't know about it when it happened, but yeah, that was like 87 or something. It was right when he was writing for Blockhead, I think. But yeah, and leave it to Jason to write a fan letter. I never wrote a fan letter to pro skaters, I don't think. But yeah, when he told me that later and the whole story, I was like, oh my God. And then knowing Jason, I could just imagine he was probably about to faint half the time or just so excited and stuff. It was just such a weird thing. But then for some reason, Neil saw something in Jason too and was like, okay, let's go hang out with this guy and have him show us some ramps and stuff like that. So yeah, he was hanging around Steve Clair a lot around 87 and 88 and stuff. And yeah, that was like the peak. That was right before Neil stopped writing Vertical. Actually, that happened in Modesto too. There was like this anti-drug fair going on and there was a demo ramp and it was like 88. And we went down from Sacramento and we were going to bring him and Mark Gonzalez and Jason Jesse and Claire, and I think Chris Miller, maybe that was 87, up to do a street demo the next day. So we were hanging out in Modesto and we got to go up on the decks of the vert ramp and stuff because we're cool people or whatever. And I remember Neil wasn't skating too much. And I was like, yeah, what's going on? He's like, dude, I'm totally afraid of vert. I'm like, and he was like top pro, you know, like one of the vert master guys. And I'm like, what? Neil's afraid of vert? And it was like something changed and he just walked away from vertical competition skateboarding. And that happened in Modesto. So that was kind of weird. Another side story. Sorry. Where were we at?
Let's change the subject a bit. So similar to yourself, Jason grew up with this sincere love of art, of drawing. It's something he's mentioned before that he'd spend hours doing as a kid, probably not unlike yourself. Because of this connection, did you sense him showing interest or support towards your art and your graphics as you were coming up working on things for Blockhead and others during those times?
Well, I remember you, at the time, I don't think I knew. He probably said like, hey, these graphics are kind of cool or something. And you know, at that time, you're just like, yeah, cool, bro. You know, or whatever, you're just blowing everything off. But later he said that because of my first model, which it was a weird thing. The owner of the company, I wanted to go pro for street skating or what was coming in mini ramp skateboarding back then. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to be pro pretty soon and stuff. And then the owner comes to me and says, oh yeah, I want you to design your own model. I'm like, no way, I'm going pro. But he's like, but no, you're not going pro, but your name's going to be on it, but you have to title it something. And I was like, huh? Like that had never been done before. And I was like, okay. He's like, yeah, it's going to be a Ron Cameron design. So you have to put that somewhere, but you have to title it. And so I was like, yeah, I'm not going to say no. So I was like, okay, I get my own model and I get to shape it and draw the graphics that I want on it and stuff, you know? And so I drew this upside down head that looked kind of Neil Blender-ish. And then this, like, I was getting into psychedelic stuff because I was so out, like nobody likes psychedelic. So that was our punk way of doing it. And Mark Gonzalez started wearing sideburns and that freaked everybody out. And I got these Argyle corduroy hip hugger bell bottoms that were like burgundy red at a thrift store with like button fly and stuff. And I'd go street skating in them. And I remember going into Tower Records by my house on Watt Avenue in Sacramento. I would skate country club, like Weinstock's department store and stuff, like at 8, 9 o'clock, and then go into Tower Records at like 9 and start record shopping. And I remember going to the import aisle and there's these two girls that came in down the aisle and they stopped down the way a little bit. She's like, oh my God, look at that guy. And the other one's like, why, where? Look at his pants. And they were just freaking out because I had bell bottoms. So anyways, I made a graphic that had like weird paisley stuff that turned into flames, this upside down head, and I named it Simple Simon because at that time I thought it was like maybe kind of Neil Blunders or something, but just breaking things down to simple elements. And I remember that being like this goofy nursery rhyme and stuff, so it just sounded kind of like ridiculous or something. And so that was it. The model was the Simple Simon model, a Ron Cameron design by Blockhead Skateboards. And I like the graphic and stuff. The shape was kind of innovative and odd, you know, and stuff. And that's what I guess Jason zeroed in on and was like, I could ride for Blockhead Skateboards because of that board, you know, is kind of the gist he gave me, which I understand because it was kind of Neil Blunderish looking. But the funny part is by the time my second model came out, Dave did it again, didn't turn me pro, and wanted me to come up with a, you know, the name again, like it'd be the Simple Simon 2. And I'm like, no, Simple Simon sucks. I can't do that. So I changed it to Tragic Comic. So Jason still calls me Tragic to this day sometimes when I'm misbehaving or whatever. So I guess that's what made Block, like he probably wanted to ride for GNS where Neil was, or maybe another company that he thought was cool or something like that. But Blockhead was like a garage company out of Sacramento. So it was kind of iffy, but I guess that board and graphic is what sold him, like, okay, they'd be okay to ride for. And Dave watched him and he was good. So we put him on the team. But I guess that's what made him like want to say, hey, I'd like to be on the team or whatever. So.
So the average Granddaddy fan probably doesn't know that their original name when Jason was just creating songs, you know, in his bedroom and maybe putting out demo tapes from time to time was actually Simple Simon. Were you aware of that at all until later on that had been going on?
Not even close until later on. And it kind of like scared me at first, like, what? Like Jason's a stalker or something. I was like, well, it's just weird. It's like, you know, I was aware of him, but all of a sudden I liked his music. But to find out that he liked my art back then, as much as now I'm starting to get stoked on what he's recording, which I called like audio zines. Because zines were these mini Xerox magazines from the 80s that you created yourself and got on a mailing list with somebody else that made a zine, and you would send them your zine and they'd send you yours. And it was like this weird underground distribution thing. And it just had weird, hilarious stuff in it. So it's another part of skateboard culture. Like Neil Blunder had a zine called Flying Fools and a couple others and stuff like that. So it was all part of the culture, but that's why I see Granddaddy music. It's just like the audio version of these zines back in the 80s that had whatever in them and stuff and nonsense and stuff and contemplative philosophical things and stuff like that. So yeah, I see all the connections, but yeah, I had no idea until I probably saw it online or in an interview somewhere or something like that. Cause I've, you know, I checked those out once in a while, but Jason never fessed up with that until like it came out and stuff. I'm like, no way. But then I was just like, that's rad, you know, because I was, you know, by that time I was kind of stoked, like, oh, he noticed. And that's when he told me, I think that's when he told me the story that he liked the board, and that's what made him want to ride for Blockhead. I'm like, whoa, cool, yeah, high five, you know, whatever. So but yeah, it was weird at first. I thought, whoa, this band that's getting huge in Europe that's done by an old skate friend of mine was named after my skateboard model. Wow. You know, it was kind of weird at first, but no big deal.
Let's transition. Tell the story about how you rediscovered Jason, specifically his music in the form of Granddaddy.
I got on into the 90s and actually moved up to Orange County. I left Blockhead and started another company called Acme with another guy from Blockhead, a pro named Jim Gray. So I was just busy, 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 busy. And then in the 90s, somehow through my friend Sam Cunningham, who also rode for Blockhead, he knew John Bacigalupi really well and was skating with him all the time. And John had a recording studio in Sacramento and had gone through like recording studio college or whatever. Like he was really serious about it. And he had Enharmonic Studio, where this club, the Vortex, used to be back in the 80s and stuff in downtown Sacramento. And he was a really cool guy. And then he was doing Heckler magazine. Heckler was music, snowboarding, and skateboarding in this like big format. So all of a sudden I was starting to hang around with John Bacigalupi and going to the recording studio because it was a cool place to be and he would let me in and stuff. And he's somehow one time, oh, he had a mini ramp inside. And he says, oh yeah, you know, these guys were over from Modesto. You know Jason Lytle? I think he used to ride for Blockhead. I'm like, oh yeah, no way. I remember that guy. He's like, yeah, he's like recording music and it's pretty good. You know, I was like, oh yeah, really? You know, cause a lot of times when you hear your friends are making bands and stuff, you're like, yeah, yeah, go Bill. Yay. But you know, you don't buy the records and stuff. But anyway, he told me about it and told me what the record looked like. And that week while I was up there visiting Sacramento, I went up to Roseville to Dimple Records, and I'm always scouring used bins and stuff because I'm a record collector. And here was this black and white CD that looked all, you know, lo-fi indie rock. And there was the word granddaddy, and I'm like, what? And then I turned it around, and I think there was like a some kind of skateboarding reference on there. And I looked at the song titles, and I'm like, this is it. This has to be Jason Lytle. But with all your healthy limbs, could you love anybody to name their kid Kim? I swear I'll never name my kid Kim. I bought it and I listened to it, and it was just, you know, it was like scrappy indie rock, but with these like interesting things to it and stuff. So I was like, oh, cool. Good for Jason. You know? So I was like, and then John would talk to me about him and stuff. I'm like, yeah, that's great. Jason's doing that. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. He moved on to music. All right. Cool, Jason. But I didn't talk to him. And then the Crystal Lake, the first Crystal Lake CD single came out that had two weird B-sides. Dying Brains, and then that Message Send, long drawn out thing.
Sarah, can you hear me now? My resonator's break.
The thing, when I listened to that, it didn't sound anything like the first one, and I was like, what the hell is this? And it was similar to what was going on in my brain in the 90s, like these, what I wanted to call new wave daydream music. But that was the song, especially when it gets into the short wave extended outro, and then the vocals fade back in a little bit, like a weird fever dream daydream kind of thing. And that's when I was like, no way, this is the kind of shit that's in my head that nobody's making really the way I want to make it. Jason's doing it. And it was like night and day from the first EP mini record thing or whatever. And so that's when I was like, oh. And John Bacigalupi was telling me that Jason was really serious about recording and learning all the equipment and all this stuff. And so I was like, whoa. So all of a sudden, like, Jason was like a fan of mine, and I was aware of Jason. All of a sudden, I was becoming a fan of Jason. So after that, they played at Casbah in San Diego, and I was like, okay, Granddaddy's playing at the Casbah, which is, you know, that was like my local club all during the 90s and stuff. And so I knew I could get in, and I knew I could be there and stuff, but I'm like, how? And back then there wasn't really internet and stuff as easy as there is now. Like, I don't even think Granddaddy probably had a website or anything. So it was just like, you know what? I just have to show up there. And when I recognize them and stuff, and then I got there and I saw Aaron, I'm like, okay. And I'm like, am I even going to recognize Jason? And then Jason was hiding in the RV or van or whatever they had. They had this weird bus thing or something, and Aaron and a couple other guys were like, they kind of recognized me, and I'm like, yeah, came to see you guys. And where's Jason? And Jason's like hiding away. And I'm like, okay, am I going to be able to say hi to him and stuff? And then he came out, he heard I was there and he came out to say hi. So we had a little reunion on the sidewalk before they played at Casbah. So that was kind of weird. And they were in these jumpsuits, which I thought was hilarious, which was like their shtick or whatever. They were like in these like work uniform jumpsuits. And that's why they didn't want people to see them and stuff before the show and stuff. So, but yeah, we had this weird, happy that could have been awkward at any moment, little mini reunion on the sidewalk, but it never quite got awkward. We were just like happy to see each other. And he was happy to know that I was there, that I was into what he was doing and stuff like that. And then we exchanged contact information. And from then on, it was just, I would stop by his place in Modesto on the way to Sacramento, or he would tell me when something was going on. Like he would always get me into shows and stuff. So we just kind of like reconnected effortlessly sort of, and then started like I'd spend the night at his house and we would just talk, and he would show me things he's working on and stuff. And one time when I was staying at his house, he took me to the garage and wanted me to listen to some songs he made for some Christmas gift CD that he was making for people. And I think that might have been the town where I'm living now, because we went into the garage and he has this baby grand piano up on milk crates. And then he has this old 70s aluminum frame with those nylon crosshatched, you know, backing and seating, you know, those old backyard California seats. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like the fold-up chairs?
Yeah, yeah.
Like total trash. That was his practice piano. I was like, what the fuck? And then he's sitting there playing these songs for me and singing all the lyrics and stuff like it's my own private show. And it was so hilarious that he had to sit all weird at this piano because he was in one of these backyard barbecue chairs and he had this half deconstructed piano up on like milk crates and sawhorses in his garage surrounded by all these boxes and stuff. And he's playing all this like lush melodic music and stuff. And I just thought, I wish I could film this. This is fucking hilarious. So yeah, because he played it for me, and then he literally live performance played it for me. And so I'm only going off memory, and I never heard it since. So, you know, then he started sending me like demo CDs and stuff of stuff that never came out. And then I would argue with him like, why isn't this on a record? And, you know, things like that. But yeah, we just kind of became creative collaborator friends, you know, and happy to see each other again. And we were from the same pocket era, enjoying the same type of stuff or whatever, you know. So
yeah, it sounds like you were being the voice of fans in terms of questioning some of his decisions on why some of those songs didn't make it on properly releases.
Yeah, I felt bad questioning him because that's fucking his art, you know. But at the same point, I felt like I understood it, like I understood what he was doing. And I understood also what it looked like at the record store when I would see people being Granddaddy fans. I understood what it looked like from that side too. So I thought, and I was like art director of magazines and stuff. And I'd, you know, help direct videos and stuff. So I'd been around and friends had record labels. All my friends were in bands and stuff like that. So it was like, when I would see something, a misconnect that didn't seem to be happening and Jason was embarrassed about it, I would step in and go, hey, you really should do this. Have you ever thought about this? Why don't you do this? This would be rad, you know? And I think, and that's a hard thing for him to listen to, but I think sometimes he did listen to it. So it was, it would scare me, you know, like when it would be noticeable that he listened to something I said, I'd be like, oh shit, do I know what I'm talking about? You know?
So tell the story about Toddzilla that you were telling me before we,
That's an ongoing thing, but he was sending me demos and some of these songs were like amazing, but he thought they were too dark. And I started calling them upside down world songs. And it was like Fare Thee Not Well, Mutineer, and The Town That I'm Living In Now, and Fuck the Belly Fudge, and all those kind of things. And those are the ones that excited me because that was kind of like my art, you know, which excited him. So then, of course, that was what was exciting me. I'm like, oh, you got to put these out. And he's like, oh, I don't know. And I think he was afraid of V2 or something. I don't know. But he was a little intimidated about putting those out. So I started pushing it. And then it was before I think The Family Cat. He was spending a lot of time on that. And I'm like, hey, you know, you haven't released anything in a while. And he's like, yeah, we're not going to be able to put the album out. I'm like, you need to do another Signal to Snow Ratio EP and put all those Upside Down World songs on it and just make it totally fucked up. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay. And, you know, that was just my attitude. And, you know, I didn't know if he would listen to it or not, but I would have loved to have an EP with all that stuff on it. And that's what I was trying to tell him. So all of a sudden, the a CD single comes out precursor to the album. Right around this time that this Toddzilla EP comes out. And I'm like, whoa, this is kind of what I described to Jason. And here's some B-sides that are the songs that I described. So it seems like he kind of broke up my idea. But here was these B-sides on the single, which was, you know what single that was?
That had I'm on Standby.
I'm on Standby. So it was the I'm on Standby single. And there was these B-sides that were hidden. And then he put the video, the animation video for The Town I'm Living Now. So it was like, okay, well, these are the B-sides. And here's this EP. I think Jason was listening to what I was saying. I never asked him, but it was just the timing was so spot on that I was like, oh, crap. Am I directing Granddaddy now? Oh, no. You know? But I was happy to see that stuff getting there. You know? But yeah, it scared me a little bit. Like, God, you know. Do I know what I'm talking about? And should I even be telling him what I think and stuff? You know, I was all insecure and stuff, but yeah, that happened. So I don't know. You could ask Jason, but I think I influenced that Toddzilla stopgap EP coming out because I kind of demanded that he do something like that. So, and there it was.
That's great. So, all right, moving on then. Back in 2010, you were planning a solo art exhibition called Dismantled Hope. And Jason had provided some songs in the form of a CD called Music Meant to Accompany the Art of Ron Cameron. Talk about how this project came about, what it included, and what you thought about the project.
Yeah, that was intimidating for me because I'd never had a solo art show before. And it was odd. It was put on by North San Diego County, which is weird. Like, what? And they had this super high-tech new media room adjacent to their new library in Encinitas. And it had this like movie screen that came out of the ceiling and all this stuff. So my friend Ron Lemon brought me over there. He's like, yeah, they wanted you to do an art show. Can you do that? And so I went over and looked at the space, and it wasn't quite like an art gallery. It's more like a conference room, but like with a beach view and stuff. It was really weird. And I thought, well, hell yeah, I get an art show. Okay. And North San Diego County was through the government, you know, and city council and all that stuff. So there was a little bit of a budget and stuff. So I was like, you know, let's make a show, you know? And so that's how it started because it fell on my lap. And then I was just thinking of like, how can I make this the best art show ever? And then I thought of Jason's songs and or his, you know, his recording style. And I thought, oh, I wonder if Jason would do background ambient music for my art show with some like shortwave stuff and weird things and stuff that kind of match what we're both into. And that started the phone conversations and emails and stuff like that. And so it went from him doing like one 10-minute loop that could be looped where you didn't really notice it and stuff like that, which he did create and it exists. And I stitched that together with a collage video loop of all this weird footage and stuff like that on the screen. So that was going on. Then it morphed into, he suddenly said that he wants to do this CD that he could sell at his tours and stuff called, you know, Music to Accompany the Art of Ron Cameron. I was like, no, you don't have to do that. What? No. And he wanted to do it. So I was like, okay. And then I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you could lay it out and stuff. I'm like, okay, I'll podge things together and make a cover and stuff. And we could put some of the songs that I like. And he has some unreleased things and stuff. So he's like, so I don't know where he really got that idea, but all of a sudden he wanted to do that. And I was like, okay. But the funny thing about that, when it actually came out in time for the art show, I think, because we had some for sale there, and then he took them on tour and stuff, but it wasn't considered an album. It was just like an oddity kind of thing. And the funny thing is that 10-minute beatless like sound, that loop turned into this 3-part thing on the non-album called My Phone Is Wet. Added drums to it and stuff, and it's not like the ambient piece, so I have this 10-minute piece that's pretty amazing and nobody's ever heard it. You know, it's kind of sad, but and then here's another funny thing. So we're talking, and they found out that Jason was going to have something to do with it, and they asked if he wanted to participate. So I'm like, maybe he could perform at my art show. And I'm like, I doubt that. He's up in Montana and stuff. So I asked him, and he was kind of into it, like, yeah, maybe I can come down there and stuff. So then I went back to the North County, San Diego people, and they asked what he wanted. And he says, just some, like a piano. They got a brand new Steinway piano that nobody had ever played, and it was tuned especially for Jason's performance. So Jason came down, and I made these like jumpsuits, like with shorts, like, yeah, they're like short length jumpsuits, and he hadn't even worn them. And they were like my fashion with like a sleeve, the wrong color and stuff like that. And I screen printed them with Dismantled Hope and stuff. So yeah, there's 4 jumpsuits that exist. And Jason, I think, still has one, but the funny thing is it didn't quite fit him. And it was like ball hugging him, and I made him put it on, and he's like, "Dude, it's tight." And I'm like, "Well, just can you play? Is it good enough?" He's like, "Yeah, I guess it's good enough." So it's like I had Jason in a slightly too small jumpsuit that was like the crotch was too high, and I was wearing the other one, acting all retarded like I like to be and stuff. And he did it. He totally did it. He did this totally great performance. And a couple of people, the filmer didn't come, but some people filmed it on cell phones at that time. So there's footage. So I would love to release that CD again, fix some typos that I fucked up on, and put that extra song that nobody's ever heard, and then put a DVD with that 10-minute atmospheric song with the video as a loop, and then that live footage, and then footage of all the artwork and all that stuff that was recorded and stuff like that. Cause I think that would be a fuller image of what it was, and put a booklet in explaining the whole thing. Cause I don't think people know what the hell that is or who the hell I am. You know, it doesn't really explain it. It's just kind of like weird, you know, it's like, what the hell's this? You know, right. You guys skateboarding and what's all this
yeah,
shit?
Yeah, I'll admit. I mean, I didn't grow up following skateboarding, and so when I found the CD, I was like, "Who the fuck is Ron Cameron? Like, what is?"
Yeah, and that's
so I had to dig back and figure out what happened. Yeah,
it made me feel weird. It was almost like, you know, Pavement or Wedding Present making a CD about me or something like that, because I'm just thinking his fans have no idea who the hell I am, and why is he being so gracious to me? Like, why is he making an album when I just asked for like a background instrumental loop weird thing, you know, like a weird sounds and stuff. So it was extremely nice of Jason, but it kind of blew me away and scared me a little bit. Like, you want to do what? Okay. You know, but he wanted to do it. So I just kind of went along with it, but yeah, it was weird. And I think what he did on it, didn't he like crossfade the songs into each other? Like, aren't they all kind of like crossfaded into each other?
I think there are a few that do that. There are some that are separated.
Okay, because I remember that made me kind of mad, because I wanted that, because I think, isn't at the mall in Klamath Falls, let me see, that like one of my favorites, yeah, in the town where I'm living now, he put it on it, and I wanted it so that fans can like take that and listen to it and stuff, and he purposely stitched those together so that it wasn't quite separable, you know? And I was like, oh, Jason, what the hell did you do? You know, but he was being all sneaky with it and stuff. So I was like, I'm glad it happened, you know, but I would love to kind of like reissue it with the DVD and the extra song and fix the typos and then put a booklet in there explaining the whole damn thing and putting like, you know, a flyer. And so then people would know what the hell it was for. And the other thing that upset me is the company that made the CDs, it was supposed to be like reverse Ford matte finish, like that textured kind of surface. And it came out just generic, kind of shiny. And I was like, oh man. So, but yeah, I still cannot believe that Jason wanted to do that and commit to that. So it's an honor, but I think it's just because I think it was his way of showing that I get him and he gets me, kind of, you know, like we share a vision and we share a passion and we have the same attitude and idea about the world and people and how fucked up everything is, but how good things could be, but we're not quite there, you know, and all that stuff. So I think that was maybe one of his ways of saying like, yeah, no, let's do this, you know, or whatever. So, but the funny thing, here's another tidbit, is I did a cover for Tape Op magazine, which is John Bacigalupi. And on the cover of the Ron Cameron CD, there's this cat with a cigarette playing this Flying V acoustic guitar. I stole that from artwork on the cover of the Tape Op issue that came out like 6 months before that. So, but it was just so granddaddy. It was like so granddaddy. I'm like, this has got to be the cover. So I made it the cover. So it's on two things. So you could have cover of the CD or the
cover. I found some quotes. I found some quotes from Jason in describing the songs that he had contributed. And you know, Jason is like, whether you want to call it self-deprecating or just not taking himself seriously whatsoever, he described it himself as a bunch of shit and a reason to clean up my desktop. And he also mentioned it at a separate time, something that better not be called my next fucking album because I really don't know if I like any of it. I just thought that was hilarious how he was kind of clearing out what he had and giving it to you.
Well, it was a little bit of everything. It was some of my favorite stuff. It was some unreleased stuff, but he wanted to do it point blank, like as a favor to me, I guess. But it was obviously not an album, but it looks like one. And that's what he was like, so because he had just gone solo and stuff. So he was so concerned that Discogs and all these things wouldn't count it as an album because this was just a collection of stuff. But, you know, when you disseminate stuff, what else are you going to call it? You know, but it wasn't top notch to the all the sprinklings and everything of a granddaddy album or a Jason Lytle album. It was kind of like that joke band they made or something like that. You know, what was the joke band they made with the rollerblader on the cover?
Arm of Roger.
This is like another Arm of Roger, except he didn't come up with a fake name. Sort of.
I don't think it was quite Arm of Roger. Arm of Roger was pretty worthless in my opinion. I mean, This though is just like all over the place. It's like there are songs included that were like just beautiful. There are songs that are strange and there's others that are just hilarious. I feel like Indie Rock Freestyle and DUI Barbecue Checkpoint are just some of the most hilarious songs he's ever created.
Officer number one is pumping the cake. Officer number two is talking to the driver of the car who just pulled into the DUI barbecue checkpoint. Good evening, sir. Have you been drinking tonight? Hell yeah, officer. I cracked my first beer this morning at 9. And I'm wasted right now. Any of you fucking pigs want to fight? Calm down, sir, I heard just about enough. Step out of the car and let me get you a cup. Now the keg is over there, and get yourself a hamburger too, and I'll introduce you to the other dudes.
Well, and that's what, as soon as he told me he was going to do that, but I was going to have to lay it out, I just shut up, because I didn't want to guide it, because Jason's doing this, and I'm like, okay, he's doing this. This makes me feel a little insecure, but I'm going to let him do it and let's see what he does because he wants to do it. And so that's what, you know, it's, I don't even know what it is. And my name's on, you know, but it's good stuff. It's funny, but I think it's stuff that he thought I would enjoy. I think that it was like a gift to me or something. I don't know. Yeah. So it's just, I just look at it as like, you know, an honorable gift that a friend did for me, and he did not have to do it, you know, because like I just wanted that 10-minute soundscape piece, you know.
Yeah, and he had those quotes that I read earlier, but he also said about it that it wasn't just a bunch of material that was comprised of tossed out rejects, and that he spent just as much time on some of those songs as he did his releases that are on his true albums. And so for whatever reason, he didn't feel like they fit the album themes that he was working on as either part of Granddaddy or his solo projects.
Yeah, so, he puts a lot of thought and time into that stuff. I assume people know that, but I mean, he really puts time and thought and meticulously goes over stuff. And so anything that doesn't reach that quality with all the sprinklings and everything and packaged with a bow on it and sent to the label is less than, and that's what he sees this as. But yeah, if this was another indie rock band, they would probably get famous over it, you know? So, because it's good quality.
So what is one of your favorite songs that Jason's written before?
Well, I would say the most favorite was one of those songs that was on some demo CD that he gave me called The Town Where I'm Living Now. Also added that to the music meant to accompany The Art of Ron Cameron, so it's on there. But I think it's like stitched together with the songs on both sides of it or whatever. But it's there. But yeah, when I heard that, I was just like, oh my god, this is the best thing ever. But it was kind of dark. It was very dark and sarcastic. But it was just hilarious, and it was completely where my mindset was. So. And I think that's one of the songs that he played for me in the garage with the rigged piano and stuff that was on that Christmas thing, maybe. It was something like that that I always wanted. And as he was releasing stuff, I wasn't hearing anything like that until he gave me that demo with that song on it. And I was like, there it is. There's that upside down world stuff, that crazy shit, you know? So I would say that's probably like the number one. And it's too bad because it's not on an album. It was almost on... It was on the advanced version of not Family Cat. What's the one before Family Cat?
Someday. Of Someday, right?
Yeah. He had it on the advanced version of Someday, like that BMG, you know, just a acetate promo thing or something like that. And then it got taken off when the promo started coming out and the album came off. So he almost, and I think that had something to do with me, but he almost put it on there, and I don't know why it got taken off. But it got taken off, and then it was just floating around again.
And so did he put it on I'm On Standby as kind of a response to your pushing him to include it somewhere?
I think so, because it's like I just couldn't shut my mouth. Every time I would hang out with him, I'm like, dude, you've got to put that on something. You know, that's the best thing ever. That's Granddaddy's best song ever. And I think he just thought it was like too dark and depressing or angry or something.
Ride BMX bikes every now and then, stopping to cry on a lawn. And the trees have turned black, and they're full of insane birds that can't remember any of their songs.
But to me, it was just hilarious. And it was. Like, I think if Jason tried to be an angry asshole, it would almost come off funny, because I don't think he can be, you know? So he's never going to be Gigi Allen. You know, there's no way. So I don't think he has to worry about that. But yeah, that song did it for me. That was exactly what I wanted out of him. And he did it. And I'm like, yes. But not too many people get to listen to it. And that's the sad part, you know? So,
you know, this was one of the songs that when I was doing this like Twitter ranking of all of his songs, I put it really high. I had it at number 4 overall. So this is one of my top favorites as well. And it would have been really easy for the people who were following in the comments to just shit all over it. You know, like, what the hell? This is like some B-side we barely even know. And instead, everyone was like, this makes so much sense that it's this high. Or they were saying, you know, I've never even heard this song before, but I can tell you right now, its position, its ranking as one of his best is valid. And I felt so vindicated that I wasn't trying to be like, you know, cute about trying to put some more unknown songs up at the top, but it really is one of the better ones. I agree.
And that's like me too. Like, I'm championing it, but then I'm going like, wait a minute, am I insane or something? Because he doesn't seem to be into it, and maybe he's right or something. But I think it's one of the most epic, heartfelt songs with, it's got everything granddaddy in it, like times 10, you know, to me. So that's what I just did not understand, why he wasn't getting behind it. But it might have been like a record label thing or something. Like, maybe their A&R guy said like, "Oh no, that's kind of too negative." I don't know the story behind it, but he kept dodging the bullet on it and removing it and stuff. And I was just like, "What the hell? That's the best thing." And I thought, like, in my grandiose mind, I thought if they released it on an album, it would make Granddaddy more popular. You know, like, this would be the thing that did it. You know, so but. Yeah, who knows? But I don't think it's bad. And there's two versions too.
Yeah.
Did you know there's two versions of it?
Right.
There's like a kind of more stripped out.
I've heard two versions.
That's the one I
heard. Yes, there's one with a lot more hand clapping. There's more hand clapping in it, and there's like some ahs instead of the synthesizer.
Exactly. Which is,
I guess, on the more produced version. It's,
and the produced version is the one that he almost included on the record, the album. And when I heard that one, I thought he ruined it. You know, because I was like, oh no, it was just so good the way it was. But the more I listened to it, I like both, but the other one sounded more polished. But to me, that first one, it just like bowled you over, like, you know, like a Buffalo steamroller.
Yeah, I go back and forth. Like, I kind of sometimes like the demo version with the hand clapping throughout the entire song just as much as the produced version.
That's, I think it's that's what I lived on for like 2 years before he redid it and polished it up and stuff. So
supposedly this song is about Modesto and being forced to live somewhere you don't really want to live. But what I find so interesting about it is that it almost, maybe it's his vocal style or the tone of the song, but it's like he almost is talking about it in an affectionate way at the same time, even though he's bringing up all these like shitty things related to this town. It's like, I called it on the Twitter, on my tweet about it. I said, it's his simultaneous love letter and middle finger to Modesto at the same time.
Well, exactly. You can't be that angry at something that you don't really love. You know, it's like fighting with your girlfriend or something, you know? So, yeah, and again, he can't be Gigi Allen even if he tried to, so he doesn't have to worry about it, you know? I used to hold people down and force them to listen to it too. Hey, this is my friend Jason, listen to this. And they would just think like, that's like a song, that's a type of song I've never heard before. But they would say it's really interesting, but I think it was so different than what you hear on the radio stuff that they were kind of perplexed by it. But they would all agree that it was very creative, you know, and if that's the worst to be said about it, that's not bad, you know?
Yeah, and I think some of the lyrics in this song are like some of his best. It almost reads like poetry in a way. Like, The trees have turned black and they're full of insane birds who can't remember any of their songs.
It just
flows. Yeah. It sounds so perfect.
And do you know when he wrote the song and then when he first recorded it? It was when 9/11 happened. And he had to remove one of the lyrics from it.
No.
Or he felt like he did. When the train goes into the lake and bubbles like a lobster, it was a plane. It was originally a plane.
Shootouts and fist fights by night in the graveyard, multi-car pileups by day, and the freight train derailed and sank in the lake, and like a lobster it bubbles away.
And then he felt like it was right after 9/11 and stuff. And he thought, ooh, I better change that. And so when he did the demo, he replaced plane with train. And you don't notice it. Like when he told me, I'm like, oh, yeah, planes have arms. That would be more like a lobster. He's like, yeah, that fucked me up so bad because it's like the other part of the lyric was about, you know, plane arms and wings and stuff like a lobster. And train doesn't have, you know, claws and whatever. So, but he just switched plane with train. So that's one of the things that world events can screw up, change art.
That's an interesting tidbit that I don't think I've ever heard. And who knows, maybe he's only just told like a select few about that. But yeah, that's interesting.
When I was hanging out with him one time, he told me about that. So yeah, I don't know if that... I don't think he has to talk about that song too much with interviews and stuff, but I wish he did.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't. Yeah, me too. Me too. All right. Anything else on the town where I'm living now? So did you, I assume this was one of the songs that you basically requested to be on the art CD. Is that right?
Oh, hell yeah.
Here, the welcome to this town sign that scares little kids with its skulls and its gore. But when you leave here, get the hell out sign is well kept and pretty with floral decor. In the town where I'm living now, in the town.
You said that some of them were by request from you, but also, you know, things that he just had kind of laying around.
Yeah, I just described what I loved in things that he had sent me and stuff like that. And then I think he just kind of ran with it there. But I think it started with town where I'm living now when he decided to do this is this will be finally where it gets put. This will be the home for it. And I think that's how this project maybe started and why it became like an albumish kind of thing that shocked the hell out of me. But it might be because of that song. Like he didn't want to just do the background ambient loop stuff with all the shortwave radio and stuff and wanted to do more. And then he thought, I could put this up, then what the hell do I do? And then that might be how it turned into this like album format kind of thing, was that song. Because I was just...
Yeah, it makes so much more sense now because this song, as we talked about, it was released as a B-side and then it was on this art CD that had a really, you know, few CDs that were actually produced, I imagine. And so it's like one of his greatest songs, like people just don't know it. They don't hear it.
Yeah,
it's nuts.
And I just...
I don't know. But at least that explains why it ended up this way.
Yeah, and it was just me demanding that be put somewhere because I thought it was one of his top 10 songs he ever wrote or recorded, you know? And it seems like, you see, just seem
makes me wonder what else is out there.
Yeah, because he's very perfectionistic about things and stuff like that. And every time I would go and hang out with him and stay at his house and stuff, he would start show and telling things. And it was all like new weird stuff. And sometimes he would say like, oh yeah, I recorded this like 5 years ago. I'd be like, what? You know? So yeah. And see, that's it. I mean, I think Jason Lyle as a human being is creative and has gifts and stuff like that. Maybe, you know, a sensitive or super observant or something that allows him to do that to the level he does it. But I also think it's what we went through in the 80s with the whole creative skateboarding explosion. That was, I mean, it's on the tail end of the whole Cheech and Chong and Animal House era. And, you know, like the stories of like Led Zeppelin and, you know, Rolling Stones throwing shit out, you know, the window at hotels and stuff. Like, we grew up in the aftermath of that, the wake of that. And punk rock was over. So how can we be outlandish now? And I would say like one representation of it, if you look at Red Hot Chili Peppers, their first album and first EPs and their very first video, like True Men Don't Kill Coyotes and stuff like that, that they came from skateboarding too a little bit. They were aware of skateboarding and they all came from punk rock and stuff. So if you look at the first like Red Hot Chili Peppers and the weird shit they were wearing and stuff like that, that's probably one of the closer relatable things to what the skateboarding world was like at that time, because that's where they were kind of getting it from. I mean, we were just buying thrift store clothes and altering it ourselves and painting things on it and putting stickers where you weren't supposed to. And, you know, like, common things. I remember in high school, I wore like sophomore year, I found old thrift store pajamas that was white with brown polka dots. And so I went to school with white with brown polka dot pajamas. And I think I tried to like fake dread my hair and put stickers in them like Steve Caballero had on the cover of Thrasher magazine or something like that, just so you look ridiculous. But that was our fun, you know, and it took some balls to do that, you know. But that's where Jason came from. So yeah, it's hard to explain after the fact, but that's definitely where a lot of Jason's creativity and the weird dark sarcasm and everything came from 80s skateboarding.
That takes us to the end of the song and the end of the podcast. Thanks to Ron Cameron for being the guest this week. Sorry it took so long to get this podcast put out there, but I'm glad I did because it's got a bunch of great stories. Ron had a lot of fun things to share. So until next time, I'm going to leave us with my little skateboarding problem. Continue with the skateboarding theme as we wrap this one up.